Welcome to Workforce RX with Futuro Health, where future-focused leaders in education, workforce development, and healthcare explore new innovations and approaches. I'm your host, Vantone Quinlevin, CEO of Futuro Health. Today, I'm happy to welcome Anson Green, a trailblazer in workforce education who has made an impact during his long career at the local, state, and national level, particularly in boosting economic prosperity for high-risk populations. In his current post, working for Tyson Foods, one of the world's largest food companies, he can have a global influence as well. At Tyson Foods, Anson leads digital and automation efforts aimed at upskilling the company's diverse frontline team members who constitute 90% of the workforce. Previously, he was State Director of Adult Education and Literacy for the state of Texas, where he expanded integrated pathway models within the Texas Community and Technical College system, amongst his many other accomplishments. He is also the host of the Behind Every Employer podcast, which I was happy to join as his first guest. Thanks very much for joining us today, Anson.
Oh, fantastic. I'm so happy to be here today and been looking forward to having this conversation with us.
Well, I know that my brief intro didn't do justice to the range of your work experience, which includes teaching at public schools and colleges and directing programs at a community college, in addition to your work at the state of Texas and at Tyson Foods. So is there a through line between all of these jobs?
Yeah, there really is. The through line kind of is the nexus of entry-level, lower-skilled workers, English language learners that are looking for career growth, looking for their next job or their first job. And then it wasn't until I looked back, but technology just seemed to always integrate in and out of my career, all the jobs I've had in. In 1997, I was teaching a welfare-to-work program for individuals that were getting a high school equivalency. And we were doing some of the first online web pages back in 1997, 98. I would have to go home and upload them, and you know, the students could watch them, you know, at a case manager's computer in our workforce center. I presented, you know, in 98 at a conference, and I remember this distinctly. There was no internet in the hotel, and I was presenting on our student webpage. And they had to trunk in like a big cable from the front office to get some internet into the conference room. So it goes back that far with technology. At San Antonio College, I started the first e-learning courses there in 99. And, you know, state of Texas, we just really expanded distance education and digital literacy for students, which really served us well when I was state director. I was there during the start of the pandemic, and we were just able to scale our system of services across the state so much quicker than many other states because we already had the infrastructure and the training and our teachers to do that. So, you know, here I am at Tyson doing some of the same stuff on kind of a much bigger scale.
Well, the population that you have expertise in working with, you talk about the entry-level, low-skill English language learner, first jobs. I mean, this is a very complicated population to work with, and yet you come to work every day excited to deliver some best practices that give them mobility and access to these great economic opportunities. What are some learnings that you've had that inspire us to be able to work with this population well?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think I kind of draw from several different parts of my career, and it really starts with demography and workforce planning. I get so inspired because our future workforce is so much more diverse, so much more language diverse. And so that's the replacement workforce, the taxpayers of the future. And they're coming in with lots of challenges and needs that our educational system sometimes are not ready to address. And to me, so it's just this economic stability and economic growth for the United States and for states that are seeing big changes in their demography. So to me, that just drives everything. And then the fact that, you know, bringing the technology to scale with these populations, which our kind of legacy education model sometimes fight against almost. I think that's really kind of the sport I love to play in, because it's really got this huge piece of just economic growth, future growth for the communities that our workers work in, and the health of our companies. We can't remain in competitive with our companies if they can't educate and train that more diverse workforce.
I remember from my past life in the California Community College Chancellor's Office, one of the learnings there was that if a student goes into remediation and is in there for over a year, they just never get out. And so you talk about legacy education model fighting against some of these practices. Give us an example of how employers are stepping in to work with the English language learner population, for example.
And you bring up such a good point, because those education models, the remediation models, they've just proven not to work for years. I taught remedial reading for 2 years at a college, and it really drove me out of doing that kind of work and into something where I could really make a difference. And it's so funny, you have that lens, that overlay of kind of constraint, I would say, in our education models, our standards, everything that we do in education seems to have this overlay of almost a deficit model of what potential is. In the private sector, you don't see that. If I were to tell you a profile of a worker at Tyson that was never been to school, comes from another country and doesn't speak English, and you know they've never had much education in their native language, you know they're really low skilled, very low skilled. If you saw the profile of that worker, you'd say, like, you know, they're only career prospects or landscaping or, you know, home health or, you know, cleaning houses or something like that. Well, we're running robots with individuals like that at Tyson Foods, and companies are doing that all over the place. They're not letting those kinds of constraints keep them from, going back to my previous comments, growing their company and growing the technology. And it's because those workers want to work. They can be trained. They're very mobile in terms of their kind of models of how to get things done, and they figure things out. And then the technology is becoming much easier to use. And so we've got this really sweet spot where robots that, you know, 5 years ago would have taken an associate's degree to be able to run, Vaughn, I could teach you how to run it, you know, this afternoon. And so it's one of those things where I think we're really letting the technology match the growing need of our employers and our workers to stay up with that technology so they can stay competitive and bring wages home to their families.
Well, let's continue down that path.
Yeah.
You mentioned your work at Tyson is exclusively focused on developing and implementing training for new digital and automation upskilling technologies. Ooh, that's a very long phrase.
Tell
our listeners about that and what you see changing for entry-level workers, aside from these robots becoming easier to use.
Yeah, and I wouldn't relegate it just to robots. I mean, technology is everywhere and in all jobs now. And I mean, I think of technology, if you think of like the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, or, you know, I say the fifth literacy, because I throw in English language. I say digital is probably becoming more important than math or writing is at work for many, many workers. And so it's not just about automation. Digital tools, digital devices are being used everywhere. And so I think the important piece there is that we've got to, first off, you know, build models that help train that workforce and help meet that growing demand, because employers don't have an option not to advance with technology. It's that or perish in the labor market and in the job market. And we know we can do it. You know, I do it every day. And, you know, it's about bringing my background and expertise with low-skilled workers. It's about bringing the education and training expertise that I have, the English language learning expertise that I have, and the digital together. And that's the gap I see with businesses often, is they don't have kind of this hybrid modality, this training development workforce that understands those different dimensions that are really the what are required for future workers and current workers. So it's a great place to be in terms of those skill sets, but it's one that I just, I see really lacking out there. And it goes back to those legacy models, because learning and development has legacy models too. And I think it's just, we're at this really, big crossroads, I think, in what it's going to take to be competitive for our businesses.
So digital is the new basic skill, is one of the learnings I'm taking away.
Sure.
Now, let me ask you this, Anson. If I were a new training and development person stepping into Tyson with 60% of its frontline workers being immigrants, many of whom have language and skills gaps, as you talked about, how would you advise me to begin designing a program to accommodate that type of diversity?
Sure. I think there's a few things that are just about how you think about that work and then how you do that work. And the first thing is you have to believe that it's possible. And even for me, as long as I've done this, when I was getting into automation, I was not sure how low I could go with training, like meaning how low a worker workforce skill could we really take the training down to. And then I went and saw workers that were really low skilled, like I've previously described, and they were doing this already. So I'm like, well, we've already arrived there. So you have to believe as a learning and development specialist that it can be done. And a lot of times that's the major constraint is they'll say, just like they do in public education, like, well, if they're not at this grade level or if they can't speak English, we can't do this. And they just have these models that constrain what is possible. And so that's the first step, is this kind of effective realignment of what is possible. But then it is about really knowing a few things that are very important. One, within companies that have diverse workforces, there are people that know how to communicate and train those workforces. They may be interpreters. They may be shift supervisors that are bilingual. There are individuals that are getting the work done every day with these populations. And so that's one area that the learning development specialist has to say, I need to find those individuals, because they're going to be kind of the secret to helping me unlock this connection that I need to make on education and training. And so this is a collaboration piece, first off. It's finding those technicians, asking around, going to plants or operational facilities and finding out how work is happening already. So there's this kind of exploration piece. And then once you've kind of got your cohort of like supporters and those subject matter experts that can help you calibrate, if you're lucky, you have someone that's an English language learning expert in the group, maybe, maybe not. But then what is really wonderful is now the technology, ChatGPT, various AI courseware tools are helping you calibrate the training down to levels that you need to do this work and get it down to. It used to be the case that, like if Anson had to create a training and get it down to a sixth grade reading level, that was going to take me a long time to manually do that and use my expertise and maybe use Microsoft Word to check the word grade levels. Now I can do that in ChatGPT or other tools in 5 or 10 seconds and get phrases and paragraphs and whole training brought to the level I needed at. And then you can do the same thing converting things into other languages. And so this brings in the untapped area of like training in other languages, which is not done as often as it should be and needs to be. But now the tools allow it to be done at a very inexpensive price. I can go convert my training to 40 different languages in about 15 or 20 minutes if I have a training course through technology. And so it's about knowing what those tools are and leveraging those to create something that's going to really get to your workforce that you're trying to train.
Ooh, you caught our attention, especially, for example, using ChatGPT to translate the training into something that maybe, let's say a fourth grade educated person would be able to digest. So what is the phrase that you would be asking the chat?
Yeah, you call that the prompts. And to me, the biggest area of exploration that everybody listening needs to think about is how to write prompts for ChatGPT or other engines like that, because that's like your search terms in, you know, a Google browser or something like that. There's great courses in LinkedIn Learning and other places to learn how to write prompts. You can find stuff on YouTube. But writing complex prompts, it's not complex to do, but they're complex descriptions of what you want. And so you give a great example, get something down to a fourth grade level. Well, you first off take, I'm gonna use things that I'm familiar with, like standard work instructions for how to operate a machine. So I have a standard work instruction that may be written at a college level by an engineer, because that's who wrote it. And I can barely understand it myself. So sometimes I ask ChatGPT, like, what does this mean? You know, and my prompt is just like, what does this mean, colon, and then I paste in the standard work instruction, just so I know what it means. But then I can take that standard work instruction, and I can write a prompt that says, you know, revise this, and I'm going to get to the grade levels a little bit, but I would say, revise this at a seventh grade level. And we're going to start there. Revise it at a seventh grade level, and check for readability. And so 10 seconds later, I've got a new revised phrase. Then I can start going to lower grade levels. Here's the trick, though. I have found getting below seventh grade level becomes tricky when you're doing technical things because you're using technical vocabulary. So what ChatGPT tends to do is replace technical words with toys and stuff like that, because it's trying to write something for a child. So your prompt says at a fourth grade level, it doesn't say for a fourth grader, which thinks it's a child. So it's writing the prompt and calibrating it. And I've found there's a great sweet spot between sixth and seventh grade level for quality. And I always give this example when I talk about doing this. And everything I describe takes my work from being like 3 weeks to develop something to like an hour with ChatGPT alone. So I did 126 of these standard work instructions on how to run a robot. Then I take them back after I've kind of massaged them down through the technology down to a low level, and I take it back to the technician that is the robot expert. And I'm like, check these to make sure they're still correct, because I've put them through this wash machine of AI and got them down to the level I want. I did 127 and only two of them came back that needed a little tweaking. So to me, that's a really good return on investment of my time. And it allows me to get what I need to get done quickly at a level of quality that is required.
That is just such a tangible example of how the technology becomes a game changer.
Oh, yeah.
And I wonder also the implications on all the English language instructors that are out there who are struggling with the, you know, the growing population that they're working with. And so how would you change how they are trained?
First off, it's, you know, it's not a competitor to the people. It's a tool and an aid. And that's always really important to keep in mind, because with automation and with AI, people have this fear of replacement. And it's about shifting, from what I see, shifting and allowing you to get to the quality, cognitively heavy skills that you need to be applying to this work anyway. And it gives you more time to do that. So that's what I love about it. All the mundane stuff of taking things down to lower grade levels and all, I don't have to do. I need to focus on the delivery model, the quality, you know, all these different types of other things that are as important or more important sometimes. But my advice is to dig in and start to use it and play with it as soon as you can, because there's nothing like kind of getting bit by the bug when it comes to using this stuff to bring value for outlining courses. I mean, I use it to do outlining, to, you know, say, you know, take this large piece of text and write it in five bullets, because I need five bullets to put on a PowerPoint slide or put into a courseware program. So it's about getting familiar with that information. But you bring up English as a second language and other languages. The one thing I can tell you is it is very good at that. And, you know, things like Google Translate and all are very good. They're not perfect. And so every time I'm doing things in other languages, I can leverage a team that can help in a wide variety of languages kind of double check my work. And so I just did some stuff the other day in Swahili. And what do I know about Swahili? But, you know, nothing at all. But I did the ChatGPT, and then I use a courseware system that creates the videos for us using an AI avatar that is basically the instructor speaking Swahili. And then I can send it back to a Swahili interpreter and say, like, make sure this is correct. And they always send back edits, so I know it's not perfect. So that's where this kind of high-skilled thinking has to come in, where you're really applying your expertise and your others' expertise to make sure that the product is high quality.
Now, Anson, tell me about this digital navigator service model that you use at Tyson. You know, how does it help your workforce? What is it?
Yeah, you know, the digital navigator is something, actually, it goes further back than Tyson for me. I started this in the state of Texas when I was a state director. And so that's a massive system. We had, you know, 90,000 students and programs all across the state of Texas. And we were doing lots of work in distance education, lots of work in digital skills. And the gap that we found was twofold. One, students need support. Two, teachers and instructors need support. And so we knew out there in our field across the state of Texas, and we have the same at Tyson, there are these maniac mavericks out there that love digital. And they're in our classrooms, or they're coordinators and programs. And we decided to kind of create a cohort and a job, basically a job description for someone that would become the go-to person in their region or in their community to support teachers, and then oftentimes in local programs, of course, to support learners. And this is what became, you know, I referenced the pandemic earlier. This is what became so critical, because when the pandemic hit, I knew I had like 140 digital navigators across the state of Texas that I could basically deputize and send out there to help us scale our program services online, which was still a massive feat, as anybody can imagine that went through that. But it's a unique skill set. I remember when I started talking about it, it really caught on, and it was before I even really knew what we were going to do with it, because there had always been like career navigators, and those were individuals that helped people get jobs or, you know, figure out their career path. And I just used one day at a conference this digital navigator. And all of a sudden, like, people are emailing, like, do you have a job description for that? What is that? We need that. And so it's really been scaled up. Now you see it in many other states. And I'm not going to say Texas was the first in this. But it becomes so important for learners, but the teachers also. And I don't want to leave that quotient out of it, because a lot of our workforce is not there yet on technology. And we went as so far in Texas as to create a call center that students could call or go online, but they could even just call a 1-800 number and get help on how to navigate in a browser or something, because they're trying, it's 9 o'clock at night, and they're trying to do their online course, and they can't figure out where their download went when they clicked download, you know, and find the file. So yeah, it's a critical element to scaling on both the teacher and the learner side.
And I forgot to ask you, we talked about digital skills being a basic skills to get started. What if somebody doesn't have the basic digital skills? Is there a resource that you would be sending your other employers who are struggling with this issue?
Yeah, I mean, the workforce that's out there, we're very fortunate, because it's the adult education and literacy workforce that is in every state and every community in the United States. And it has had for the last decade an increasing focus beyond reading, writing, math, English to digital. And those are really the only workforce out there that has that nexus of the digital knowledge and the ability to teach, but the ability to teach that low-skilled workforce. And that's what you're looking for, is like, you know, show somebody how to like log into their email system using and create a complex password. You need someone that knows how to, you know, work with English language learners and understand how to make a dollar sign with the shift key and the number 4 and things like that. So that's the kind of workforce that you need if you're a business. And they're willing and have a mandate to collaborate with businesses. So it's a no-cost solution. It's in your community. And they have a job to do for businesses. So it's a great connection. And it's one that, of course, I know and love because I've spent most of my career in that world. So it's an invaluable resource, but it's not tapped by businesses near as much. And I have a work group of businesses I work with that kind of help connect them to those resources and things like that. And I get called on to do that frequently because it's kind of a hidden jewel in everybody's community.
Well, thank you for that tip. Mm-hmm. Two more questions, Anson.
Sure.
What excites you about the future of learning?
I've done some reflection on this recently, actually. And, you know, I was excited in the late 90s with the internet and with getting adult learners and entry-level workers using the internet and opening email accounts and all of that, you know, and I just loved that kind of cutting edge fire of like, this is a new technology. And I feel like that's the same place we're in now with AI and with automation. We have this kind of new onslaught of technologies that are rapidly evolving much quicker than the internet did in terms of deployment. Plus the fact that I love helping, mentoring, coaching, cheerleading our public sector partners at colleges and our schools and our business partners along that path. So I feel like it's like a second fusion of like this kind of confluence of technologies that are coming out so quickly, and people are wondering how to do this or what's the best option or how do I build this? And it's really disrupting things. I think education and training is going to be so different looking in the next few years than what we're used to. You know, I use an avatar-based AI training system that allows me to bring a subject matter expert right into the training, you know, program, and I can make it say whatever I want. I don't have to have the, you know, trainer from the college on the phone to help me build this or have a meeting in person with someone that's a training expert. I can use them, send them some information, get their standard work instructions, and I can create and bring a live instructor through an AI chatbot or AI avatar right to the learner. And so that gives us a lot of value in terms of being able to get the expertise straight to the learner without having to do all this extra scheduling of experts.
Well, technology is certainly disruptive in a wonderful way. That's another great example.
Yeah.
And so let's end by having you tell our listeners about your podcast, Behind Every Employer, and why you started it and how they can find it.
Sure. You can find it on any podcast app, you know, Apple, YouTube. Just look for Behind Every Employer. And I started it because I really love having this conversation that we're having now about this kind of connection of employers to work and entry-level workforce. And so, you know, the Behind Every Employer is a workforce of entry-level workers. And I felt like we needed a forum. There were so many podcasts on high-skilled work and STEM and, you know, all these other types of things, but not a podcast that was dedicated to entry-level workers and what businesses are trying to do to help out on the fronts of immigration, on the fronts of education and training. English is the second language. We're in the middle of doing a series on AI. And so it's a way for businesses to kind of tune in and kind of hear what other businesses are doing, because the peer sharing is critical at a time like this. And we are so happy to have you on as one of our first guests.
Well, I had certainly a lot of fun being on that first episode. Thank you very much, Anson, for being with us today. I mean, all the examples you gave us on how technology is being leveraged for the low-skilled workforce was super insightful, and I'm sure our audience learned a great deal.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
I'm Fontone Quinlivan with Futuro Health. Thanks for checking out this episode of Workforce RX. I hope you will join us again as we continue to explore how to create a future-focused workforce in America.